Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the session on anal rectal diseases. We're happy to be here moderating for you. I'm Jen Beatty from Creighton in Omaha, Nebraska, and
I'm Brooke Gerland from Stanford. Nice to meet see everybody.
Friendly reminder to turn off your cell phone devices so they're not ringing. We have six awesome panelists today that are going to be discussing. We're going to save all the questions for the end, so save your questions. We'll bring everyone up at the end so you can ask them some questions. Thank you. We'll get our first speaker ready.
All right, yeah, you can see we like to run things on time. I'm going to introduce Natalie Krilcheck from Stanford. She's going to use a lot of alliteration in her talk, talking about access to the anal abscess. Come on up.
Good morning. It's nice to see so many people interested in benign anal rectal disease. I'm a colorectal surgeon at Stanford, and I have no disclosures. So it's actually really difficult to figure out what the incidence is for anorectal abscess because so many of them drain spontaneously or in the office. But the best guess is about 100,000 abscesses in the U.S. per year. And of those, about 40% will result in anal fistulas. We know that anal abscesses are not a life-threatening situation for most of our patients, but they can be a huge pain in the butt. So today we're going to review the anatomy and the pathophysiology. I'll be brief because there's really nothing new there. We'll talk about some anesthesia considerations, technical considerations, and then three special situations of the deep postanal space infection, Crohn's disease, and neutropenic patients. So we all remember our basic anatomy of the dentate line, the internal sphincter, and the external sphincter divided into the subcutaneous, superficial, and deep components. However, I really like this picture because it shows an anal gland. In this picture, the anal gland is going through the internal sphincter just into the intersphincteric space, but anatomic studies have shown that it can actually go all the way through the external sphincter. And when the entrance to the anal gland gets blocked, the bacteria can't go in and out, they fester, they create an abscess. The infection can then track along the intersphincteric plane or through the external sphincter muscle. That's 90% of anal abscesses. The other 10% are not cryptoglandular, so those are caused by malignancy, HIV, trauma, foreign body, radiation, Crohn's, TB, and hidradenitis suppurativa. So these are the spaces that the anal abscesses go to. The perianal space is often from a submucosal or intersphincteric tracking of the abscess. The intersphincteric space is between the sphincters. The ischioanal space, or ischio, also known as the ischiorectal space, is outside of the external sphincters, and the supralevator space is above the levators. One space that we often forget to talk about, and some anatomists will disagree about the existence of, is the deep postanal space. This is behind the rectum. It is proximal to the anococcygeal ligament, which isn't really a ligament, but it is a dense fibrous band that runs between the coccyx and the anus. And if you get an infection underneath that, it's often not going to necessitate to the posterior midline on the outside because of that fibrous band. So it's going to go around the anus into the ischiorectal space, and that's what creates a horseshoe abscess, but also it makes it difficult to diagnose the original source of the abscess. So once you're in the OR to drain the abscess, there's two basic positions, prone jackknife or lithotomy. I think that patients who hate anal rectal disease are often operating in lithotomy. It's cramped in there. It's cramped between the legs. It's hard to get the light right. It's hard to get an assistant. So for the surgeon, both the ergonomics and the visualization is significantly better in prone jackknife. The problem is that you either have to intubate every patient and then flip them, which is pretty much overkill for a 5-minute abscess drainage, or you have to talk your anesthesiologist into doing prone MAC. But they don't like that because they feel like they don't have access to the airway. But once you start operating in prone in prone jackknife, you really won't want to go back to lithotomy. So if you're trying to talk your anesthesiologist into operating with prone MAC, there is actually data out there that says it is safe. This is a paper from 2006, which had 448 patients over 3 years. You can see from their complications, they had only 2 patients that needed to be flipped and converted to a general anesthetic, and 1 patient with hypoxia. So if you're just starting to operate prone MAC, you should keep the bed in the room, because if you have the bed in the room, then if your anesthesiologist gets into trouble, it literally takes 30 seconds to pull down the drapes and flip the patient so that they have access to the airway. You want to start with shorter cases and patients with low narcotic tolerance. Okay, so now you're in prone jackknife, and you're going to drain the abscess. We all know that you have to go as close to the anal verge as possible to make the fistula track shorter if they do end up developing a fistula. You should go parallel to the external sphincter, although this really only matters when you're close to the anal verge. One other thing you can consider is a Pezzer tube or drain. This allows you to save skin and not have a lot of scarring around the anus. In 1988, Dr. Beck et al. Published a series of about 55 patients. Their fistula rate was 50%, which is in line with historic controls. Patients tolerate they don't really like the tubes coming out of their bottoms, but they tolerate it better than packing of an anal abscess. And speaking of packing, there actually is no value in packing. There are several studies, including this one from 2015. It was a pilot study, so only 14 patients, but you can see that the mean time to healing and the median 2-week postoperative score were vastly better, with a significant p-value, in the patients who did not get packed. There are also multiple other studies that show it, but they're all of similar size. So the last question is, do we give antibiotics? And the general consensus is no. This is the biggest study. It's 183 patients, of whom 151 were treated per protocol. 22% of the patients who did not get antibiotics and 37% of the patients who did get antibiotics had recurrent abscesses with an anorectal fistula. And that said, the guidelines still allow and encourage antibiotics for patients who are immunocompromised or who have sepsis, or induration and cellulitis. This was a study of 172 patients. It was retrospective. 63% of them got antibiotics. But you can see that even though there's no statistically significant difference, the rate of recurrence was twice as much in the patients who didn't get antibiotics, but only in the patients who had sepsis or induration or cellulitis. Okay, so operatively, the last question is kind of when do you drain internally? So if you have an intersphincteric abscess that you drain through the skin externally, then you're going to create a fistula where you wouldn't have needed to create one. So those can be drained with an incision in the anal canal through the internal sphincter. If those abscesses then extend proximally into the supralevator space, then you can drain the supralevator component into the rectum. Because if you drain it perianally, you're going to end up creating a supralevator fistula. On the other hand, and abdominal sources of supralevator abscesses should also be drained through the rectum so that you don't create a fistula. If you have an ischiorectal abscess that then tracks to the supralevator space, then if you drain those internally, then you're going to create an extra sphincteric fistula. So those should be drained to the perianal skin. So our three special topics. One is the deep post-anal space infection. This is the most commonly missed source of sepsis, and it's the most common reason for recurrent abscesses or complex fistula, usually because you think it's coming out on the side, and you don't drain the deep post-anal space. This is a patient of mine who was on vacation when she started having anal pain, so she didn't come in for about a week and a half and had a very large abscess. Here you can see the opening is in the posterior midline. You can see the hole into the abscess. Classic teaching is to do a modified Hanley procedure, which includes an internal sphincterotomy, posterior drainage of the deep postanal space, as well as counter incisions to adequately drain the abscess. I think the most important aspect of draining a horseshoe abscess is to drain the deep postanal space. So if you only drain the side component, it's never going to control the sepsis. The newer recommendations, you can do a seton if you don't, and you don't need to put large counter incisions. You can also put drains into those sites. Crohn's disease is another big one that we struggle with. So symptomatic fistula disease in Crohn's can have some relief with of symptoms with antibiotics, but the key here is that that pus under pressure still needs to be drained, even in Crohn's patients. They can't actually do their treatment, which is infliximab, in the presence of an active infection, and you're not going to hurt anything by just draining the pus to the skin before referring them to their GI colleagues. So last one is neutropenic fever with perianal sepsis. This is a disease process with a mortality that was originally described at over 50%. But now with better supportive and interdisciplinary care, we can drop that mortality down to less than 10%. It can still be a diagnostic challenge because patients may have pain without erythema or induration or suppuration. And so you don't know if they have anything that is surgically accessible. So MRI is used liberally in our patient population, and it is the diagnostic modality of choice because you can see smaller abscesses than you can see with a CT. All of these patients should be started on broad-spectrum antibiotics and antifungals. I'm sure your oncologist will be giving them GM-CSF, especially if their absolute neutrophil count is less than 1,500. Surgical intervention is necessary when there's progressive infection and also for tissue necrosis. If they get a necrotizing soft tissue infection, those are the patients that have a mortality from this disease process. But more often what's going to happen is that they start them on antibiotics and they're going to feel better. And then once their neutropenia resolves, then they can build the mount the response to make an abscess, and some of them will need drainage at that time. Early intervention was suggested in the past, but newer studies suggest that 40 to 50% of these patients can be treated with antimicrobials alone. And that's it. Thank you.